This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how are you this Thursday afternoon? Good to be catching up with you. Today, the WA Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis is not happy at all with the $107 million that her federal counterpart has set aside to assist the phase-out of the live sheep trade. She's written a stern letter to Murray Watt, and we'll talk about that in some more detail after news headlines at 12:30 today. Also today, Geoscience Australia is looking forward to discovering all the hidden mineral wealth that exists beneath the country's surface. They've got a lot of money in the latest federal budget. They're going to use that to map all the resources in Australia. And also a little later this hour, taking you to the 25th Dairy Innovation Day, which is underway right now on a farm near Brunswick Junction in the state's southwest. It is 12:06 here on the Country Hour, and a number of WA citrus growers are looking to get out of the industry due to the rising costs of production. Jason Sayer grows a variety of mandarins and oranges on his farm at Wokalup, 150 kilometres south of Perth. He's been in the industry for over 20 years, but that all comes to an end in 2 weeks when he'll be pulling out rows and rows of his trees. He says the final decision to get out of the industry was made late last year.
Basically, we made the decision October last year at the end of our production year that we weren't going to carry on. So we've basically had the trees in caretaker mode for 6 or 8 months now with the intent of in 2 weeks' time we're going to pull them out. So there's been no inputs. They've been on maintenance water, had no fertiliser. What you see on the trees at the moment is what they're trying to do of their own accord. So, yeah, there's a lot of practices we do to produce a good piece of fruit. None of that's happened in over the production season.
How many trees are you pulling out?
Well, there's just under 1,500 in this block, and we've just decided the size of the block, the whole lot will go. We've made the decision to move on to something, another venture. So if we're going to pull 10 out, we'll pull the whole lot out.
What's that going to look like when you're saying you're going to pull them out?
We will use an excavator with a grab. They'll get windrowed up and basically burnt, try and burn them the day we pull them out.
What type of varieties have you got here?
So we got two varieties of navel oranges, Navelina and Late Lane, and two varieties of mandarins, Hixons and Imperials. And they're all on varying rootstocks, which has given us the advantage of we generally produce fruit from June through till the start of November. And our customers were able to supply an orange and a mandarin at the same time. So we have a large window, picking window.
Did you have in mind that you wanted to be a citrus grower? Is that what you know, that was your goal?
Oh, the trees at the time we bought the place were only 3 years old, so they were sort of halfway. They hadn't started producing yet. So, yeah, it was the attraction. I was always been interested in agriculture, so more than happy to... Yeah, it was something interesting and it's been a good journey.
And I understand you're coming from a wet and sheep property. You also grow feed for birds?
Yes, well, we've dabbled in here having the water and the good climate over summer. It's been ideal for growing the millets, the sunflowers and that sort of crop, so summer crops.
What's it like growing food for birds versus growing food for humans?
There's probably a better return in growing food for budgies than what there is for people at the moment. When you weigh up all the costs of labour inputs and that, it's certainly easier.
Let's just focus on that for a second. As a citrus grower, you're saying you're getting better return for growing food for budgies than what you are for humans. In 2 weeks' time, you're about to take out your trees. Is that a factor, that decision? Is that why?
Oh, I think the volume even though we're quite a small area of citrus, the volume of work is super intense. So our picking, we can have 10 to 15 people here while we're picking. We run 3 or 4 people through the packing shed. We produce up to 120 tonne of citrus, so we do that over a 3 or 4 month period. It's a lot of volume, a lot of work, and it's all got to be done properly.
This piece of this navel orange here, what would this cost you to get it to market?
Generally, our costs are going to be around $1 a kilo by the time we pick and pack. And then on top, they're just our production costs. And then we've got our water, our labour over the growing season, our fertiliser and all that on top. So,
And what are you getting back for this?
Somewhere between 80 cents and $1.30, depending where they go. So
are you making a profit?
Of late, probably not. Yeah, it's slowly been declining. So that's probably part of the reason we're a lot of work, not a lot of return, easier to do something else.
Jason Sayer, he's a Wokalup farmer in the southwest of the state. He was speaking to Kate Forrester, 11 past 12. Further north, Carnarvon citrus grower Tamara Chinnery says if you don't start buying local fruit and supporting local growers, you eventually won't be able to buy an orange grown in Western Australia. She says local fruit is so much fresher and nutritious than the imported fruit that's often been in cool store for months. Let's follow Tamara out to her orchard, which grows beautiful fruit, but for how long, she's not sure.
We, at one stage, did consider ripping our orange orchards out because we just couldn't compete with the American fruit. We'd send our fruit down and they'd be wanting to give us $1.20, $1.50 a kilo for it. It's beautiful fruit. Last year's prices were much better, but 1 year in 10 doesn't really make a living. And, you know, it does sort of eat into your psyche a bit because it's such a gamble. I think to be a farmer, you've really got to be the sort of person who'd go and put a bet on a mad horse.
This year, how much did it cost you versus how much was the income for your oranges?
The prices have been quite reduced this year. It's a bit of a weird thing. We don't understand what mechanisms are behind it, but for some reason, when the wholesalers bring in imported fruit from Egypt and America, that tends to sell perhaps wholesale for $4 a kilo. And our fruit, which is probably 4 months fresher, hits the market and they want to give us $2 a kilo for it. So we just don't understand that. But yeah, that's the way the market seems to work at the moment. There seems to be some sort of a consumer prejudice against local produce, which is a bit of a worry.
Why do you think that is?
I have absolutely no idea. Because, of course, freshly picked fruit is brimming with vitamin C. It's fresh. It's got a lot of juice. The imported fruit, it looks beautiful. It's bright orange because it's been in cold storage for such a long time. But it's generally just starting to break down.
How does it make you feel when you see the imported fruits are getting more than local fruits from yourself?
I think our wholesaler does his very level best for us to try and get the best price he can. But there is a perception that local fruit can be grabbed up for less money. What the actual retailers sell it for, I'm not sure. They could be buying American or Israeli fruit for $4 a kilo and selling it for $8 a kilo. And they're possibly buying our fruit for $2.50 a kilo and selling it for $8 a kilo as well. So it seems to me sometimes to be a game of screw the farmer. We can't continue to support running at a loss to supply the Perth fruit and vegetable market. So if something doesn't turn around and change in terms of wholesalers' perceptions, and perhaps the federal government needs to step in here, but if people are continuing to bring imported fruit in because it's cheap, they're going to end up with nothing from the locals because the locals slowly, bit by bit, are shutting down. So I think the consumers really need to get behind local growers and say, hey, we support you and we'll buy your produce and try and get those wholesalers to consider their practices.
Tamara Chinnery speaking to Sophia Alston. It's 12:15 here on the Country Hour, and the citrus story is pretty similar right across Australia, with the rising cost of production causing many growers to stop and ask, is this really worth it? Nathan Hancock is the CEO of Citrus Australia. He says it's a very challenging time for the entire industry.
It's a significant area of concern for our industry. There's been a number of seasons now in a row that have been quite difficult. And as you say, margins are being squeezed by, you know, various impacts across the whole country. We're seeing it in far north Queensland, right round to southwest Western Australia.
Is the feeling from the sector, well, where are these prices going to level out? When does that stop?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, we've not only had a global pandemic to deal with, but the wars that we're experiencing, or we're not experiencing, but the world's experiencing, are affecting either access to or movement of really key products for agriculture that we rely on that are sourced from other parts of the world. And products like fertilizer and agrochemicals, for example, have been impacted by that and can continue to be, even though we've seen some of the other things settle down when it comes to interruptions caused by COVID. There are ongoing problems with a number of supplies and items like you're talking about.
And shipping is associated with that, isn't it? And that seems to be a real problem, getting product out of some producing nations safely.
Correct. It's about bringing imports of inputs like fertiliser. Shipping has to go on extended routes around dangerous areas or can't access ports. And the same when we export our goods. It's adding days to our travel to certain countries as well. So, yeah, on both sides of the ledger, growers are paying for that in terms of increased inputs and also increase in export charges.
What's the consequence of that, Nathan? Are you seeing people now leaving the industry or considering leaving the industry?
Oh, it's certainly having an effect where if you're in a marginal situation, the last couple of seasons have been very difficult. We're seeing pressure from retailers to keep prices down, but growers having to pay, you know, extra costs. Like you've talked about, we haven't talked about internal transport. That's another significant impact where the transport industry has been affected by retiring truck drivers has made an immense impact on the national supply of transport drivers, and that's driving up the costs of moving pallets of produce around the country. We are starting to see a number of people exiting the industry. It might be through either going into other horticultural crops, or they may be putting their properties up for sale, perhaps as a group of properties to try to attract investment from other businesses. I think it's probably heightened over the last couple of seasons.
Nathan Hancock, he's the CEO of Citrus Australia. Well, one shining light for the citrus industry is the juice market. The per tonne price of some juice fruit has increased from $20 a tonne to $200. And that's because a disease has wiped out citrus trees in Florida, creating a global shortage of orange juice and juice concentrate.
That's gotten to the point where supply out of Brazil can't meet demand. And that means that the Australian citrus industry is now meeting the demand of local juice and juice drinks type products that had traditionally been or recently been filled by Brazilian imports. And so what that means is that the price for off-run oranges, so oranges that don't meet the specifications for retailers but could be used in juice, now have a more viable home. And that means that profitability overall is increased. If this trend continues, which we believe it will, that type of fruit that doesn't meet those specifications could be juiced at a profitable rate for growers. And I think that's a significant change in what's happening for the industry nationally. It's not just going to be affecting one area, but all areas are going to benefit from this need for Australian juice to meet different types of products that are made from orange juice.
That's the CEO of Citrus Australia, Nathan Hancock, and he was speaking to Joe Prendergast. It is 20 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Shortly, an update from the newsroom, and then we'll check weather conditions right around Western Australia.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
And we'll just stick with citrus for a little bit longer today, because one of the country's largest supermarket chains is replacing those net bags with paper bags for its mandarins this season, all in a bid to try and reduce some of the plastic waste. Coles says the new 100% recyclable packaging will avoid the use of almost 12,000 kilograms of plastic in 1 year. Fabio Spiniello is a grower liaison officer for Venus Citrus in South Australia's Riverland. He's all for reducing plastic waste in the industry and says there's already been a lot of work, time and money invested into trying to find more eco-friendly options for packaging.
Yeah, we've been marketing recyclable packaging for probably half a dozen years or so. Helen and Maria that lead our marketing team sort of gone down that path. You know, we're going into sustainability growing, and we've also got growers that grow. We have an eco brand. So there's definitely chemicals that aren't used on that citrus, and they're packaged in that way as well. And it's been quite successful for us, not just here in Australia, but we have exported quantities overseas as well. Obviously, it's a higher demand or price return for that fruit, but it's been a slow road, but it's improving all the time.
Talk me through your recyclable packaging options. So what packaging do you have, and what's this recycling packaging look like and involve?
Well, we used to always use plastic trays and plastic sleeves over the trays. We've gone to cardboard trays. They are more dearer, but in the long run, it's better for the environment and better for everybody in turn. And even our plasticky type shrouds over the containers, they're recyclable as well. So it looks good, it's better. It is a little bit more costly, but we're trying to do the right thing by the environment. And we're improving all the time. The product's improving all the time. And yeah, we'll keep going.
And was this move to more recyclable packaging, was that driven by Venus Citrus, or was that something pushed for by your supermarkets and people you supply to, or a bit of both?
Well, we definitely pushed this well before the supermarkets approached us about it anyway, before we started supplying them. So we've been doing it for a fair while. I'd say with our eco brand, which has been up and running for probably a good dozen years or so we were already in that process of going down that path. So it's been a good dozen plus years for us.
And the net bag is something that people have often associated with citrus. I mean, you can get avocados and other onions in it too, but citrus in the net bag is something I've always thought about. But I've heard that's kind of disappearing.
Oh, not really, not with us. We do a very large program with mandarins and even oranges in the net bag. And we run a couple of different types of bags, right up to a high-grade piece of fruit at a certain dollar value, and then to a class two or so piece of fruit at a lesser value, which we use different bags for. So for us, we use a Venus Black bag that has the premium fruit or premier fruit in it. And then we have a sweet and juicy bag that has the lesser grade fruit in it, a bit more marked and blemished. But as we all know, citrus is, doesn't matter if it's marked and blemished on the outside, the inside's just as sweet as a perfect piece of fruit on the outside. We also, our class two trays, we actually tell a bit of a story. We have a cardboard recyclable tray that is marketed as Kissed by Nature. So we use that as a class two. And instead of just using a plain black box, and that's been received in the market sensationally over the last couple of years, you know, it just keeps improving. And I think when you start to explain to consumers what's going on and make them aware, obviously we're able to move more product that way. So yeah, we've just got to educate everybody and tell them that's a good piece of fruit.
Venus Citrus Grower Liaison Officer Fabio Spiniello. Planet Ark Chief Executive Rebecca Gilling says plastic isn't necessarily the enemy, as paper can have a large footprint. But, she says, reducing unnecessary packaging in the first place is key.
Plastics is obviously an issue that is really top of mind for many consumers and householders. But I think one of the distinctions that needs to be made is about plastic per se and plastic pollution. I think what concerns people is when plastic escapes into the environment. Also, I think when we lose plastic to landfill, we're obviously losing a valuable material. At the moment, of course, we don't have a recycling, a widespread recycling solution for soft plastics, which we had previously on a fairly small scale. But without that, then there is no solution for those soft plastics in the main for most people, except going into landfill. So we do have a lost resource there. But the key thing is to keep them out of the environment. So reducing their use in the first instance is obviously a very good thing. In terms of its comparative footprint, if you like, there is quite a lot of research done on life cycle analyses of paper versus plastic. And, you know, there are a great many variables involved here. But I think what people don't understand is that in many ways, paper has a bigger footprint. It has a bigger land footprint. It has a bigger water footprint. And what its carbon footprint is dependent on its source and where it ends up. In the case of the coal situation that we're talking about here, we're obviously replacing something that is not currently recyclable with something that absolutely is recyclable. So in that sense, it's a really good move because it's reducing the amount of waste that is going to landfill, and waste, as we know, represents lost value.
So I've talked to some local packing sheds here, and they say they've been looking at more recyclable packaging for quite a number of years, and they feel that they've been leading the charge rather than the supermarkets. Is that something that, you know, Planet Ark, do you think supermarkets are doing enough to reduce packaging overall, especially maybe packaging that's in excess?
Well, I think that, yes, across the board, they are doing what they can to reduce the amount of packaging they're putting on the market. And I agree that the brand owners are really doing their bit very much as well. It's in response to a real community concern. I mean, I know when Coles surveys their customers, plastics and packaging are really at the top of their lists of concerns. So they are, in fact, responding to what their customers are telling them. So I think, look, yes, they are. There's always room for improvement, as we know. And the message from Planet Ark is really to avoid unnecessary packaging, bearing in mind that plastic has a role to play, particularly in the area of avoiding food waste. Plastic is great for keeping food fresh, but we don't need, for example, to put our bananas in a plastic bag because they've already got their own packaging that does a very good job of keeping it fresh and protected. So from the consumer's point of view, we need to think about what is necessary packaging and what is unnecessary packaging, and vote with our purses. And as we can see, the supermarkets and the brand owners are alert to that and respond.
Planet Ark Chief Executive Rebecca Gilling, ending that story by Eliza Balage. It is 28 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Now, just at the start of the hour, you heard the story about a couple of citrus growers here in Western Australia, one in particular, Jason Sayer, who, well, at the moment, has been growing a variety of mandarins and oranges in the southwest of the state. But just with those rising costs of production, it's something he's been thinking about for a while, but in a couple of weeks, he's basically going to be pulling out rows and rows of his trees after being in the industry for over 20 years. And it's a challenge not only happening here in WA, but across the country. Joe Prendergast has put together an online story for you to have a look at. So if you just search citrus production costs ABC, you'll find that story, and you can see Jason Sayer there just walking through his orchard. Just terrible to think that those trees are going to be pulled out of the ground in just a couple of weeks' time. You also heard from Tamara Chinnery. She's a grower in the Carnarvon region. She's also thought about it in the past. At this stage, she's going to keep going, but have a look through her orchard as well. As I said, just search citrus production costs ABC to see the online article that's up for you right now. It is 29 past 12. Jonathan Beale is in the studio with the latest news headlines. Hello.
Hello, Belinda. A 46-year-old woman accused of killing a friend and injuring two other men in a high-speed crash in WA's southwest has formally entered pleas of not guilty. Melissa Jade Anthony is accused of driving at speeds of up to 185 kilometres an hour when her vehicle struck a tree near Calgup in September 2022. Ms Anthony is due to face court again in early August. The Federal Health Minister says the government is yet to determine how a new multi-million dollar digital mental health service will work. Tuesday's budget sets aside nearly $600 million for the program, which is not set to commence until 2026. Mark Butler says details of what type of support will be offered and how it will operate have not been finalised. And Bureau of Statistics data shows Australia's headline unemployment rate rose to 4.1% in April. The result means the unemployment rate rose by 0.2 percentage points last month, up from a revised 3.9% in March. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much for the update, Jonathan. It's 29 to 1. And between now and the news at 1, it is off to Mount Barker today. Tracy Kilner is going to be along. She'll go through the cattle results for you, the yarding and the prices. And also, we're going to be making our way to the southwest of the state very shortly. And it's Dairy Innovation Day 2024. It's being held at Brunswick Junction. So we'll catch up with Richard Hudson, who's made the trip out for the conference today. And also, $500,000 being set aside to basically map all the hidden mineral wealth that exists beneath Australia's surface. We'll take a closer look at that project shortly. And in just a moment, it's off to the Bureau of Meteorology. You are tuned to The Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia, streaming live on the ABC Listen app and, of course, on the website, on the ABC Country Hour website. Good to have you along this afternoon. Let's make our way now to the Bureau of Meteorology. Luke Huntington with you this afternoon. Luke, let's start in northern and eastern parts because there's been a bit of rain about there. That's where the most activity is. What have you got?
Yeah, that's right, Belinda. Similar to yesterday, most of the weather's over sort of the very far eastern Gascoyne into the south interior and into the far northern goldfields. We don't have any really observations up there, very sparsely populated and with the Bureau network up there. So pretty much can only rely on satellite imagery to detect the thunderstorms up there. So we haven't really recorded any rainfall up there in the last 24 hours. And that'll continue during the remainder of today, but we'll probably weaken by this evening. In terms of later in the week for Friday, we might see another area of thunderstorms pop up just in the very far northwestern Gascoyne on a trough through that area. Through the afternoon and evening, there could be some isolated showers and thunderstorms through that area, but fairly insignificant falls through that region, fairly light, so we're not expecting any significant rain. And another feature is with the high strengthening to the southeast of the state, it will become windy over the northern parts, mainly over the Pilbara and Kimberley area. And those winds ramp up during the weekend with that ridge strengthening to the south. So we'll have those fresh and gusty east-southeasterly winds returning throughout that weekend period. It'll probably increase the fire dangers up there. So maybe getting to some extreme levels along parts of the Pilbara coast there. But yeah, in terms of any further rainfall after Friday, there's nothing forecast.
All right, let's turn our attention out of the Southwest Land Division. How does it look this afternoon and as we head into the weekend, Luke?
Yep, again, it's going to be the same weather pattern over the next 5 or 6 days. We see that ridge to the south, and that's going to dominate the weather pattern for that period of time. It has created a bit of fog over the south coastal districts in the last couple of days, you know, around the sort of the Albany Esperance area and just to adjacent inland. So that all probably might continue into tomorrow morning. The winds do pick up with those easterlies over the weekend. So fresh and gusty northeasterly winds, specifically near the west coast there. And another feature is quite above average temperatures for this time of year over much of the southwest land division. So generally around 4 to 6 degrees above average, but over the weekend it's probably going to be close to 6 or 8 degrees above average along that west coast. So some parts are still sort of hitting maximum temperatures, reaching about 30 or 31 degrees around that sort of Kalbarri, Geraldton area. So abnormally warm for this time of year. And then yesterday I did mention that there was something coming in late next week. There is a front still on the forecast for sort of the Thursday period. The latest models unfortunately have sort of weakened that system, so it doesn't look like as significant as we thought yesterday. So it doesn't look like it's going to be one that pushes far inland and even weakens as it gets to the coast. So it is still 7 days out. The models may change, but yeah, at this stage it looks like it's weakening, unfortunately, pushing against that strong high.
All right. Well, let's hope there is a change to that situation and we do get a significant front coming through at some point anyway. Luke, thank you for going through those details.
Thanks.
It is 25 to 1 here on the Country Hour. It's off to Mount Barker just before the news at 1. Tracy will go through the yarding and the prizes at the cattle market for you. First, though, just a quick word on the rainfall, and it will be brief. This is a look back at the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning and checking 5 mils and over. In northern and eastern forecast districts, just one to report. In the interior, Carnegie 11. But as Luke was saying, some of the sites, they don't have any readings. So it's probably a little bit more in some parts than is actually reflected in that just 11 at Carnegie. And then in the southwest land division, no rain over 5 millimetres in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. 24 to 1. Western Australia's Agriculture Minister has had a good look through the federal budget, and she is not happy with the $107 million that her federal counterpart has set aside to assist the phase out of the live sheep trade. Speaking at a media conference, Jackie Jarvis says she's written a stern letter to Federal Agriculture Minister Murray Watt.
We will always do what's best for Western Australia, and we will do what's right for West Australian farmers. As you know, I've written to Minister Murray Watt, the Federal Minister, to say that the support package that has been offered to West Australian farmers on the ending of live export is not sufficient. I'm here today to say that we will continue to fight for this. I have fought for this since day one of becoming the Agriculture Minister, and I will continue to stand up for Western Australian farmers. What is most disappointing is the $107 million package that has been announced doesn't go far enough. And disappointingly, it appears that 40% of that funding seems to be going back into federal government programs and business as usual activities. So I am calling on the federal government to come to the table again and actually let's really work through what we need to do to support farmers.
Jackie Jarvis doesn't think Murray Watt's policy has broad support in Western Australia. So is she calling for a reversal of the recent announced phase-out date of the 1st of May 2028?
Minister Watt knows I don't support this position. The federal government will say that they took this to an election and they won that election, but we would like the decision changed. I am realistic, though. Murray Watt is saying he took it to an election. We have been advocating for this ban not to come in since I became the Ag Minister. I've certainly let him know that this decision is not good for Western Australia. It is not good for farmers. And I don't think it has broad support across Western Australia.
As I mentioned earlier, Jackie Jarvis says she's not happy with the $107 million that's been set aside to assist the phase-out of the live sheep trade by sea. And she's pretty frustrated at the lack of detail about how and where it's going to be allocated.
So look, we certainly presented numerous case studies. I tabled them in Parliament last year. We had all of the economic modelling. We know it's going to cost the economy, you know, around $123 million per annum. We certainly want more money for processes. One of the frustrations is we don't actually know what's in the package. There has been a global figure announced. Of the $107 million announced, only about $64 million is actually earmarked for our abattoirs, for our farmers, for our community mental health programs. The rest of the money seems to be getting channeled back into Commonwealth programs. As a starting point, we certainly need more money for our processes, for our abattoirs, to actually expand operations. They are at full capacity now. They are willing and able to expand their operations. We would like a little bit more federal government support to do that. And in the meantime, separate to this, we have asked the federal government to step up and assist with freight subsidies immediately. We need a release valve to get sheep off farms now.
Jackie Jarvis says she's had 12 meetings so far with Murray Watt advocating for WA sheep producers, but she's encouraging industry to be visible in Canberra.
I'd also encourage our lobby groups, our farm advocacy groups, to get on the plane to Canberra. We've got that Canberra hub there for this exact purpose.
That is the State Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis speaking to the media yesterday afternoon. It is 20 minutes to one.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The nation's peak mining and exploration body has welcomed a $7 billion commitment to the processing of critical minerals in Australia. The budget commitment will come into play in 2027, and it's going to be spread across 10 years, allowing critical mineral miners to apply for a 10% tax credit when processing. AMEC CEO Warren Pearce is over the moon.
It's a really key component of getting a new value-adding industry up in Australia and indeed in Western Australia. So we're delighted to see that funded with $7 billion across the next 10 years committed for those companies that can get into a value-added product. 10% production tax incentive will help make them internationally competitive and much more likely to get these projects up.
Is this what you were hoping for?
Yes, it is. It's very close to what we asked for. What we tried to do is look at what was being made available in incentives in other nations, particularly the United States, and we took their idea of a 10% production tax credit and brought that idea into Australia. That's pretty much what the government's committed to, with caps and limits around it, but that's an important commitment. And indeed, we genuinely believe this will deliver the incentive we need to get these projects up.
So how exactly will it work? Because it's not coming into place until 2027. So how will it work once it's in place?
Well, what it is a 10% production tax incentive. So what it means is it doesn't subsidise any mining costs, but for the production costs of the value add, so the value added product that comes from the critical mineral, so realising greater value from those minerals, they'll be able to access a 10% credit. So essentially it'll reduce their production cost of the value added mineral by 10%.
Do you expect that this will actually spur those new industries on, the onshore production will actually expand as a result of this? Because it's a lot of money in the hope that it will. But what sort of evidence do you have that that is what will happen?
Look, it's still going to be very hard. I mean, it's very hard to get critical minerals mines up, difficult to raise money for them, and it's going to be difficult to get into the value-adding piece as well. That said, we've got many Australian companies that are committed to trying to do this. They just need the right incentives in place and the certainty in place to know if they give it a shot, there'll be support for them. But ultimately, there's about 150 companies exploring for critical minerals across Australia. There's about 60 with proposals for downstreaming and probably about 20, 25 projects that have near-term potential. And if we get half of those up, we'll be doing extremely well. But there's a real commitment within industry to making this happen, and having the support from the federal government is really important.
There are obviously miners out there, Warren, who are in production, and talking specifically about nickel, which was added to the critical mineral list earlier this year. We know that sector has already had some assistance because the price has fallen so dramatically over the last year. Given that this new fund won't come, or this new commitment won't come into place until 2027. Is it too little too late for example, the BHPs who are currently looking at the future for Nickel West and potentially placing the entire sector on care and maintenance? I mean, is it enough for looking particularly at that nickel sector?
Look, I don't think it's going to make any difference for those, for that company. I think the reality, there won't be any immediate assistance under this proposal. It may be that the government looks at other more direct financial assistance. I don't know. However, what it does do is it creates the incentive, if indeed those projects go into care and maintenance, to bring them back out in several years.
So, Warren, if you dust off your crystal ball there and we sort of look ahead to 2037, what sort of industries could, what could the landscape look like? What could we be seeing?
Look, I think we'll see. I mean, I think there's a range of critical minerals that are most likely to see value adding happen. Obviously, in Western Australia, we're well aware about the lithium efforts with lithium hydroxide. I think we'll see another commitment in that space from Covalent, which is Wesfarmers and SQM, over the next year. That's important. We'll also see the rare earth projects move forward. I think you'll see value added products in that space. But I also think you'll see them in vanadium, in graphite, and in cobalt, as well as potentially in nickel towards the end of the decade. That said, a little disappointed to see the opposition come out and oppose it. I think we've always enjoyed strong bipartisan support for our industry, and our industry's always enjoyed strong support from the Liberal and National parties. We're hopeful we can bring them around, persuade them of the overwhelming benefits that come from this proposal. But if that isn't the case, we still think there's a pathway through the crossbench, indeed supported by Labor, the Greens, and some of the crossbenchers.
AMEC CEO Warren Pearce speaking to Tara DeLandgraft, and very happy with the $7 billion commitment to the processing of critical minerals in Australia. That was part of this week's federal budget. And it is 12:45 here on the Country Hour. Still on resources, the CEO of Geoscience Australia is really looking forward to discovering all the hidden mineral wealth that exists beneath the country's surface. Also in this week's federal budget, $500,000 has been allocated to an ambitious plan to map all of the resources in Australia. The job's going to be done by Geoscience Australia, which is the federal government organisation that looks after the nation's geological data. CEO James Johnson says the work will support the Australian mining sector and broader communities for years to come.
Anyone who's flown across Australia and looked out the aircraft window, you know that much of what you're seeing below is red sand and or soils, and not a high proportion of it is outcropping rocks. And a lot of the mineral wealth that we're seeking is actually hidden. So the data sets we're acquiring are all about seeing through that top layer, the sandy layer, for example. And so the sorts of data we're acquiring are using tools of geophysics, so things that measure the electrical conductivity of the subsurface, things that measure the magnetic signature and measure the densities through gravity surveys. When you piece all of those together, you're able to start to map out the geological units that you actually can't see because they're obscured by that overburden. That's what we're about, and then we apply our knowledge of how different mineral deposits form to find the right environments that might be prospective for, the, in this case, the critical minerals that the nation needs.
Is it a case of piecing together work that's already been done, or will you be flying new surveys?
That's a great question. It's a combination of both. Some of these will be new airborne surveys, but there's a great wealth of data from pre-existing surveys, and our challenge will be to identify where we need to add value to the existing surveys, where we need to get higher resolution data, for example, but certainly we're always stitching together what the new data acquisition reveals with the pre-existing data so that we get an increasingly comprehensive picture.
The media announcements use the term pre-competitive geoscience. Is that the kind of speculative exploration work that resource companies are themselves are unlikely to do?
That's exactly what it is. Pre-competitive geoscience is the earliest stage of information gathering, and it comes before private sector investment, not instead of it. If you think about it, we're doing regional surveys that an individual company wouldn't do because they will routinely have taken out a specific patch of ground under license or under a tenement, and they can't monetize a much more broad regional scale survey. We are doing the regional work that provides effectively the prospectus that will attract mineral exploration companies to take up the ground that they think they're interested in within that broader region that we've surveyed. So it's the really early stage information.
The announcements also mentioned that for the first time, the Resourcing Australia's Prosperity, or RAP project, is going to map our offshore areas with the aim for carbon capture and storage and perhaps sites for clean hydrogen projects. Would that involve seismic testing?
No, it won't involve seismic testing. The work we'll be doing is around, there's a elevation measurement called bathymetry. So we're basically measuring the shape of the seafloor. That will be highly relevant to offshore renewables projects. For carbon capture and storage, we will be utilising existing seismic data that demonstrates the structure of the below the seafloor in the areas where the data has been acquired. That'll be useful for identifying potential reservoirs for carbon dioxide. It also will have the potential to highlight areas where there are thick salt formations, which are the right geological environment for hydrogen storage if we were to utilise or want to seek hydrogen storage in the offshore environment from, for example, from a nearshore, an onshore adjacent hydrogen production facility. The salt formations, engineers are able to create caverns within those salt formations, and they're suitably impermeable that you can inject hydrogen into those artificial caverns and store it more or less indefinitely until you need to extract it again to either utilise or export.
Geoscience Australia's CEO, Dr. James Johnson, speaking to Lucinda Joyce. And before him, you heard from AMEC CEO Warren Pearce just talking about the $7 billion commitment to the processing of critical minerals in Australia, that little gem found in the federal budget this week. In response to that, Linda at Mount Hampton says, "Congratulations, federal government. Critical minerals get financial assistance, and the citrus farmer is pulling out trees, and the sheep farmer is getting out of sheep. When will you understand that you can't eat rocks? Oh, sorry, I forgot. You can't fill your purse from primary producers. Shame on you," says Linda. The text is 0448 922 604. Also, just a few moments ago, you heard from WA Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis just saying that she's written a stern letter to the Federal Agriculture Minister Murray Watt, just saying she is not happy with that package, the $107 million transition package to assist the phase out of the live sheep trade. Quite a few in response to that on the text. The Old Woolly says, "If the minister was serious, she would stand up for the trade and not for hush money. What a joke, as this money will go straight back to government. We need the live export trade." John in Forrester says, "Minister Jarvis speaks with a forked tongue. She supports WA's sustainable live sheep export industry, but opposes WA's sustainable native forest timber industry. As our agriculture and forestry minister, she is inconsistent and can't be trusted." This from Robert at Mora. "Jackie Jarvis does sound convincing. Is it huff and puff, though?" This too, Malin Woodnilling. "Minister Jarvis says we should go to Canberra. Watt wouldn't meet with industry to announce the live sheep end and money for abattoirs so that they can pay us below the cost of production. What we need is markets and competition." And this too, "I've been doing dam catchment and dam clearing for about 10 years, husband and wife team, and paying off machines business has already dropped due to sheep export ban. We don't get any compensation." Thank you for that, Chris in Mount Barker.
0448 922 604. Text through. Let me know what you're thinking this afternoon. It is 7 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. The 25th Dairy Innovation Day is underway at the moment on a farm near Brunswick Junction, about 150 kilometres south of Perth. Richard Hudson is there. And Richard, after such an extended dry spell, what's the mood been like this morning?
It's actually been surprisingly upbeat, Belle. It might partly be because it's such a gorgeous day. There's blue skies everywhere. But I think it's also because when I drove in, everything is actually looking green, which surprised me. But I chatted to Dale Hanks, who farms not far from here at Harvey, and he said on May the 2nd, they had about 75 mils of rain. And then last Friday, another 10 mils. So that's what's bringing this feed up right now. It doesn't mean the grass that I'm looking at on the hills here is actually being eaten by the cows at the moment. So the farmers in this area are still having to bring trucks in full of very expensive feed. But what it means is they're not far away from having some relief. Some of the other farmers here are saying they're actually tired because they've been feeding for longer than they normally would. They haven't been able to get away and have a bit of a rest. But at least that rain came at the right time. And things are starting to look up.
Well, the event's taking place on a farm today. What does it look like as you take a look around the place?
It's looking amazingly picturesque. It's Melville Park, which is quite an historical dairy farm. It was established in around 1882. At the moment, it's actually being run by a couple, David and Barbara, and they've got all sorts of things here, like heirloom vegetables. They're producing cheeses and they've got a distillery and some honey, all sorts of things. But historically, it has been a dairy farm. And this morning at this dairy day, John Shine spoke, and his grandfather bought the farm in 1918 off, believe it or not, Andrew Forrest. So it was a relative of billionaire Twiggy Forrest. Quite a story. He had a fascinating reminisce about the Holstein dairy herd that he had here and how they were innovators with some things, like with embryos. I think they had some of the first embryos brought in here back in 1979. But the sad moment when he was when he was reminiscing about the very last milking they did, and then when the cows were put onto a couple of double-decker trucks. And he said, I remember watching it going down the driveway and watching one of the old girls nibbling some leaves off a gum tree. And he got quite emotional. Just makes you realise, you know, farming's more than just a business, isn't it?
Mm. If we look across the country, Richard, milk production is down to its lowest level for 30 years. Is that the case here in Western Australia?
No, it's interesting. They mentioned today that milk production in the last year in WA has actually increased by around 3%. Now, that really surprised me because they've just had their driest year on record. Even John Shine was saying that. He said he's never seen anything like it. So I asked a few people and said, you know, how can that be? And the reason is a lot of the milking in WA revolves around summer when things are growing. They're often reliant on their own feed that they have, but because they've run out of feed this year, because it's gone on so long, they've had to buy feed in, and the feed they've been buying in has been of good quality, better quality than what they would normally have. And dairy farming is like a lot of things. What you get out is dependent upon what you put in. So if you're putting in good quality feed, you're getting decent quantities and probably good quality milk that's coming out the other end.
And just quickly for us, Richard, the Dairy Innovation Day event itself, who's there? Who's going to be interesting today?
There's a lot of interesting speakers. There's just been a session there where there's been about four quite young dairy farmers. It was interesting listening to them. I love listening to the ones who are not so polished in front of an audience or in front of the media. But there's also a gentleman who's come over from the eastern states, and he'll talk about how flooding affected his farm and how he was actually watching some cows getting washed away. I'm very much looking forward to his sad story, but it'd be interesting to see about the resilience and how he's recovered anyway.
All right. Look forward to hearing more from the day today. Thank you for that, Richard. Appreciate it. Richard Hudson, who's at the 25th Dairy Innovation Day, currently underway on a farm at Brunswick Junction, 150 kilometres south of Perth. It is 2 minutes to one. Let's head to Mount Barker now. Tracy Kilner is waiting to go all through the details of the yarding and prices today. How was it, Tracy?
It was a good sale. Numbers were down for a mixed quality yarding of 1,113 head of cattle. The heavier weight young cattle gained with demand, with steers selling to 320 cents and the heifers to 276 cents. Lighter weights were less in demand. The grown heifers trended up and cows gained in all qualities, with heavy weights selling to 208 cents, while the heavy bulls reached 200 cents a kilo. The weaner steers sold from 150 to 320 cents, and heifers made from 80 to 276 cents a kilo. Yearling steers returned 136 to 290 cents, while the heifers sold from 182 up to 268 cents a kilo. Grown heifers weighing under 540 kilos made from 190 to 292 cents, while the heavier weight heifers returned 200 to 220 cents a kilo. Heavy cows sold from 158 to 208 cents, while the store cows gained, selling from 90 cents to 168. Heavy bulls gained, returning 144 to 200 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you so much for going through all those details at Mount Barker today. I really appreciate it. This just on the text from Peter in Albany regarding Minister Jackie Jarvis. Not heard on the Country Hour often. She usually says she's in regular contact with Murray Watt with concern. But now there's a publicised stern letter, saving live export or saving face or saving her cabinet spot. Unconvinced, says Peter in Albany. And this too from Luke in Mucka. Industry does not want taxpayer-funded handouts. It just wants competent governance that does not interfere with free enterprise. Thank you for being part of the show today with all those texts. I appreciate it. It's time for the news. It is now 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.